Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with a Bay Area guy from Occident Invicta. Bay Area guy, it's great having you back on.
Yeah, it's great to be back on.
So we were going to discuss this article, The Pitfalls of American Exceptionalism. And we recently met up in person in San Francisco. So I was thinking we could kind of find ways where we could sort of tie the topics of the trip together with the article.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. And in many ways, the Bay Area is sort of a microcosm of American society as a whole.
In a good way or a bad way?
Well, I think mostly in a bad way, but it has its virtues as well. Because in many ways, if you look at the overall sort of course of American society, a lot of these recent changes originally began in California. I mean, the fast food industry has its origins in California, not the Bay Area specifically, but the state as a whole. Recent demographic changes, which are affecting the nation slowly but surely, have reached their zenith in California. And the Bay Area, what makes the Bay Area so fascinating is that the state embodies virtually all aspects of American society. Not only is it socially liberal and progressive, I mean, the Bay Area was gay-friendly before the Supreme Court recently legalized gay marriage, but what makes the Bay Area contradictory is that it also is very much a plutocratic region, and no city embodies this contradiction better than SF.
Yeah, I remember a while back, didn't you write an article about the demographics of the Bay Area?
Yes.
I noticed, like, when I was driving up on the freeway through, like, the San Jose area, I was in traffic, and I noticed, like, I was observing the people in the cars, and basically every single person I saw was either Mexican, Chinese, or Indian.
Well, that's the changing demographics for you, but what also makes, speaking of demographics, what makes SF unique as a large city is that its diversity is mostly Asian. For a big city, it has relatively few blacks and Latinos. And in fact, blacks and Latinos in SF have actually been declining in the city. The black population is down to 6%, and many Latinos in the Mission area, which used to be predominantly Hispanic, have either been evicted or have been made to move out on account of soaring rental costs.
One thing I noticed in San Francisco, which is different than Southern California, is in Southern California that Latinos do most of the working class jobs, and there's a lot of Asians who tend to do white collar jobs. But I noticed in San Francisco, you see Chinese people doing a lot of the working class jobs that Mexicans typically do, like bus drivers, janitors, like stuff like that.
Yeah, you definitely get a wide range of Asians in SF, from rich techies to working class types. SF is definitely probably the most Asian of America's big cities.
So when we met up in the Union Square area.
Yes, around Market Street and Powell. SF can be quite a difficult city to navigate at times. Even I, as a Bay Area native, had trouble finding my way, and the parking situation can be quite a nightmare.
So how long did it take you to find a parking space?
I'd say about maybe 10 minutes.
Well, that's not that bad.
Not terrible, but I would say SF has increasingly become a Hobbesian competition for space, whether it's parking or housing.
What's interesting is a lot of that has traditionally been because of the geography. There's been the way the bay is situated, but in Southern California, I mean, Southern California is on a huge basin, and it still has the same problems with the real estate crisis. So both Southern Southern California and the Bay Area have a lot of the same issues.
Right, but in the Bay Area, I would say that these issues have been compounded by the rising influx of tech workers into the Bay Area, becoming increasingly gentrified. And to go back to the contradictions of the Bay Area and SF in particular, the Bay Area, in many ways, represents American capitalism at its fullest. I can't think of too many regions in the country that are more capitalistic and more profit-driven than the Bay Area, with Silicon Valley at its heart.
One thing that I did notice that's interesting about areas like Union Square and North Beach is, on one hand, they're very expensive gentrified areas. They're major tourist destinations. But one thing that sort of impressed me was how they've managed to preserve a lot of the character. You have, like, businesses that have been there since, in some cases, the 1930s. A lot of cities, mm-hmm. like New York has had the same issue with gentrification, but in New York, basically, like, all the older businesses have been pushed out. But what's fascinating about San Francisco is, despite how expensive it's become, they've still managed to preserve a lot of the historic character.
Well, exactly. And that's what I meant when I said that the Bay Area sort of represents the best and the worst of the United States, and especially from an economic standpoint, because on the one hand, the Bay Area represents the best side of American capitalism, innovation, small business, and SF has indeed done a remarkable job of preserving its character and retaining local businesses. But at the same time, despite its progressive credentials, SF is the second most unequal city in the entire country. Housing prices have soared, and there's a lot of friction, especially in the Mission area.
Yeah, I think Miami is number one in terms of income inequality, and then New York and LA are up there too.
Yeah, as one journalist once quipped, despite the fact that SF likes to fancy itself a progressive European-style city, its income inequality bears more of a resemblance to sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah,
definitely
that
a
is
major
true.
Contradiction.
I think one of the reasons is you bring up like issues like mass immigration and the whole tech industry. Another factor is, I think in Europe you have many different cities that have a lot of character, charm, and history. I think the problem with America is, like, most American cities are really just awful. They have, like, with, like, ugly strip malls and tract housing, that the few cities like San Francisco that do have a lot of character, everyone wants to live there, and the price is, like, they become really expensive. I think part of it,
the problem
is because America has such few cities that have that kind of charm.
Well, it's a tragedy of the commons in many ways. And going back to immigration and the influx of tech workers, there's one more point I want to make, because when describing the plight of Latinos in the Mission who are being evicted due to rising prices caused by the arrival of these Silicon Valley types, these leftists can very clearly see the adverse impact that immigration has on the lives of everyday people. They can recognize that mass immigration can bring about displacement, it can ruin the culture, it can destroy a sense of community and identity. And in fact, one local Latino activist in SF denouncing the techie influx and gentrification said that the city was losing its soul. So in this context, they can see that mass immigration, unfettered immigration, is no boon. And yet somehow, when it comes to non-white immigrants coming into majority white countries, they suddenly treat immigration as this unadulterated good.
Do you think it's inevitable for these issues to take place in a major city? I notice among, like, traditionalist types, there's sort of a hostility to big cities. A lot of people want to move out to the country and like live on farms. Do you think it's possible to have an urban society and still have a strong, vibrant middle class?
Well, I think you can, but there must be also be a sense of common good and certain laws and restrictions designed to ensure that big business doesn't get out of control, because that's precisely what you have in SF right now. You have a huge, rich class, a lot of them tech types, and then you have a burgeoning homeless population. You have more and more people who can't pay rent or make ends meet, and SF has lost much of its middle class. And I think, you know, one of the greatest symbols of this business culture out of control in the Bay Area is Uber. And I actually wrote about Uber in my post, because recently the California Labor Commission forced Uber to treat its workers as employees. And just today I read an article which claimed that Uber had failed to properly vet its drivers, and that many of them, despite Uber's supposedly stringent background checks, in fact had criminal records, and some were even sex criminals. And I don't think the people who run Uber are idiots. They know full well what they're doing, and yet they're so avaricious that they just do not care about anything but profit. And to me, it's completely unsurprising that they reside in SF.
Yeah, that basically sounds like what libertarians want, like a society with no government regulations of business.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's what makes SF sort of different from other well-known liberal cities. As opposed to, say, Seattle, Portland, or Austin, SF has always been liberal, but it's liberal in more of a hedonistic, do what you want, live and let live sense. It has more of a libertarian feel to it. It's not like Portland, where you have hipsters telling you to use proper pronouns.
So you're saying it's more hedonistic, but there's less of a social justice warrior presence?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. You know, people in SF are too busy rooting for the Giants, exploring these new places, eating at all these good local restaurants, to really ponder issues of privilege or so-called cultural Marxism or the like.
Can you go over some of the positive aspects of the Bay Area?
Well, the Bay Area, it's certainly home to a lot of innovation. I mean, we have Silicon Valley. The Bay Area is the bedrock of today's tech economy, for better and worse. And the Bay Area also has a wide range of geographical diversity. There's a great place to hike in the Redwoods. If you like the water, you can live in SF or even the nice parts of Oakland. There's a lot of different locations and a lot of different cities with different characteristics. So in many ways, there's something for everyone, depending on what kind of lifestyle you enjoy.
One thing that is really great about the area is I was also impressed by how much open space is conserved. And basically where I'm from in Southern California, if you go to, like, if you're in L.A., you can drive from L.A. to the Inland Empire or down to Orange County and just see nothing but ugly cities. But in San Francisco, I was pretty impressed, like, right on the outskirts of just to the south of the Silicon Valley, you have lots of countryside. And then once you get past San Jose, there's also a lot of open space for San Mateo County. So I think that is one of the great things about the Bay Area, is I think they've done a better job conserving wilderness than Southern California. A place like, you went to college in Orange County. I mean, Orange
Yes.
County, like, every inch of wilderness is covered in ugly tract housing.
And all the housing looks the same as well.
That's one thing
it's very easy to get lost down there, because just strip mall after strip mall, these nice and yet identical suburban houses that all look the same, and there's no real character to Orange County.
And in San Francisco, like, every... I think that's part of the reason, as I was saying, it's overpriced. That's also, it's what makes it a unique place, that there is so much. There's a natural beauty, but every single neighborhood you visit, like, even no matter how expensive they are, like Union Square, North Beach, they have their own, like, unique charm to it. It almost feels, in a sense, it has a very European feel to it.
A European feel, but without the European economic security. I think that's the best way to describe SF.
True.
Well, SF is undoubtedly a nice place to live, but the fact that it's a desirable location, that alone does not account for the soaring housing and rental costs. There's also different forces at work, and like I said, it's social justice meets social Darwinism, in so many words.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to point it. A lot of that describes basically the corporate elites. They're social Darwinists who pretend to be humanitarians. I wanted to save the topic of Donald Trump later in the show in the election.
But Donald.
Part of the appeal to the Donald is that he's so just brutally honest about who he is. He doesn't try to put on this facade like a lot of billionaires do.
Right, and I think that in many ways, far from hindering him, his enormous amount of wealth is actually, it enhances his appeal, because I remember during the Republican debate, someone took Donald Trump to task because a decade or two ago, he had donated money to the Clintons. And someone said, you know, you're this Republican, how can you donate money to people like the Clintons? And Trump, without missing a beat, basically said, you know, that's how politics works. You donate money to both sides, so that way your concerns are addressed regardless of who wins. And I think that refreshing honesty resonated with many voters. And I even remember Larry Wilmore sort of mocked a lot of these presidential candidates who intended to go to Iowa, try to dress up all folksy, fit in with the natives, whereas Trump is going in on his private jet, and he doesn't care. And I think people actually respect him more for that, because as opposed to the Clintons, who try to convey this sort of folksy, common man aura, even though they've made over $100 million in speaking fees, Trump is just, he unashamedly embraces his plutocratic status.
And I think he was a big sort of 80s icon. I think the culture of the 80s was a lot more, the rich people in the 80s were a lot more honest, when you had the sort of, like, example of that would be Gordon Gekko in the Wall Street movie, like Greed is Good. There was sort of, then the 90s, you had the whole sort of trend where David Brooks has a book about it called The Bobos, where the rich people, like, pretended to be, like, progressives and hippies and humanitarians. But Donald Trump sort of represents, he's very much symbolic of the 80s era in New York.
Right, and I think a lot of voters are just tired of having their intelligence insulted, where these sort of paternalistic, patronizing people such as the Clintons try to claim that they can feel your pain and that they're just regular, ordinary people, despite their enormous wealth. Whereas Trump, he says, yes, I'm an elite, but I'm an elite who's going to fight for you, and I'm going to use my power and wealth to, you know, get things done and make some changes around here.
And he is talking a lot about, on, like, immigration, ending birthright citizenship, and reforming. He wants to, he's not going to scrap it completely, but he's talking about reforming the H-1B visa system.
Right, and what's funny is that despite the fact that Donald Trump has been branded an extremist, it turns out his views on immigration actually more closely align with the general public's than these open border types. And Kevin McDonald actually recently wrote an article on it where he cited a study showing that a combined 52% of Americans either want to shut off the border but allow a few skilled workers in, shut the borders completely, or deport all illegal immigrants. So Trump's views are resonating with growing numbers of white Americans, and I think another part of his appeal is just how unapologetic he is. For example, following his assertion to the effect that millions of Mexican immigrants are rapists and criminals, he was excoriated by the mainstream media. But far from backing down and apologizing, he just stuck to his guns. And I think a lot of white people sort of yearn for this unapologetic white masculinity that doesn't apologize, that doesn't back down, that doesn't go around walking on eggshells. I think that's why he appeals to so many middle American types.
And, yeah, there's this professor at UC Davis. His name is Professor Matloff, and he's in computer science, and he's been a big critic of the H-1B visas. And he's actually a progressive, actually, interestingly enough. He's a supporter of Bernie Sanders, but he praised Donald Trump's immigration platform.
Well, what's interesting is that you mentioned Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders, despite the fact that many brand him this far-left socialist extremist, his views on immigration actually go against the prevailing consensus within the leftist establishment. I wrote an article about Bernie Sanders being pilloried by Vox because Sanders essentially dismissed open borders as a Koch brothers conspiracy. And he argued that
That was Ezra Klein interview where Ezra Klein asked him about immigration, and he said open borders is like a right-wing conspiracy.
Right, and that's interesting because anti-immigration sentiment is usually associated with the right, but in this case, Sanders is actually sort of flipping it around and claiming that supporting open borders makes you either a supporter or a right-winger, a supporter of right-wing policies, or a right-winger yourself. And so he's sort of, that's his clever way of denouncing open borders, I guess you could say.
Yeah, because it's one of the leading causes of income inequality in the country. And back to our original topic of, if you just look at the cities with the worst income inequality, they're the Bay Area, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Miami.
Well, right, they all have significant immigrant populations, and I believe Jared Taylor once made a point to this effect, but it makes absolutely no sense when you're decrying income inequality and an equity gap in education to advocate bringing in yet more poor people, more uneducated people, more unskilled people.
On the issue of the Bay Area, I mean, what are solutions you see in that area of improving the quality of life? Do you think these problems are, like, permanent?
Well, it's hard to say, to be honest, because the way things are headed right now, it's only going to get worse before it gets better. But I think for the Bay Area to benefit, there needs to be a change in California as a whole. Because I read an article about the legacy of Prop 13, where basically big corporations today only have to pay property taxes based on the 1978 value of properties they currently control, whereas new companies have to pay property taxes based on today's current property values. And so this sort of allows these big plutocrats in the state of California to retain a sort of monopoly to a degree. Until we have new tax laws and new policies that sort of temper the influence of these corporate giants such as Uber, I don't think things in the Bay Area will get better, and I don't think raising the minimum wage alone is sufficient.
Do you think that the H-1B visa program has had a huge impact on the Bay Area?
It's hard to say. In certain industries such as tech, it certainly has had an adverse effect, but for most people in the Bay Area who are not involved in tech, I wouldn't say that it's had too much of a negative impact. But nevertheless, it's this mentality that supports H-1B visas that's the problem. More profit, more cheap labor, more immigrants. and the hell with native-born, everyday working Americans.
What are some of the areas that you see, you notice that Southern California is different?
In Southern California? Well, I mainly was exposed to the Orange County area, so I can't really say that it was anything to emulate. I mean, sure, there was an abundance of wealth, but there was a lot of strip malls, a lot of uniformity. And more importantly, one thing I noticed in Orange County, which actually sort of jives with my observations about the Bay Area, is that you have a lot of these laid-back libertarian types, people who are fiscally conservative but socially liberal. Basically, people who have no problem with gay marriage, immigration, but who just want to keep all their money. And I even had a friend in college who was like that and who called me a racist because I wanted to impose immigration controls. And he's this rich Republican type, so you get a decent amount of those in Orange County. Just like you have a lot of social Darwinists and social liberals here in the Bay Area.
So the rich Republican types are really not that different than the rich liberals?
Essentially, no. And in fact, ultimately, they serve the same elites. And there are actually a few Republican types in the Bay Area. You have a lot of these rich entrepreneurs who, despite being liberal on issues such as gay marriage, tend to be against public schools. There was one entrepreneur named Timothy Draper, I believe, who even proposed dividing California into six separate states just because
it would benefit
rich Republicans like him.
He wanted the Silicon Valley to become its own state, so it would be the wealthiest state. Then what would happen is the Central Valley...
Yeah, because clearly Silicon Valley doesn't wield enough influence as it is, right?
Yeah, they get their own two senators. And then also, like, the other Central Valley would become the poorest state in the country, like, poorer than Mississippi. Because they don't want to share their own wealth with California.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back from San Francisco, I stopped in Los Gatos.
Los Gatos, it's somewhere in the peninsula region, but I can't say I've actually been there.
It's a beautiful area, but it's one of the most... I'd say it's one of the most opulent cities I visited.
Most opulent?
Probably one of the wealthiest. It's also the interesting thing is also super white.
Yeah, I mean, white people are a minority in the Bay Area, but if you go to places such as Marin County or Hillsboro or Atherton, then there are still these wealthy white enclaves, many of whom embody the attitudes that I mentioned also exist in Orange County.
Their mentality is the same. The culture is the same in that sense. The only difference is the aesthetics, is the Bay Area is more aesthetically pleasing, and places like Orange County are culturally trashy. But other than that, it's sort of the same mentality.
Well, that's saying that Orange County even has a culture.
No. Another thing I've noticed is different about the culture is in San Francisco, like, wealthy people try to put on an image like they, as if they're sort of like, they try to like dress like they're European, in a sense. In Southern California, like, you see guys with like luxury sports cars or Hummers, but they're dressed like really trashy. They're like covered in tattoos. They have like backward baseball hats. Like, I didn't notice
they're wearing
that
flip flops. Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah,
them very well.
It's in Santa Barbara too, but I didn't see that in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, the Bay Area people certainly do try to carry themselves with a certain class, a certain sophistication, especially in SF. And I even remember growing up, a lot of liberals around me would frequently extol the virtues of European countries and how much more educated and sophisticated they were than Americans. So in many ways, you could say certain white people in the Bay Area are like people from Argentina who regard themselves as transplanted Europeans.
I've made this point before in another show, but what is ironic is that the leftists actually want to emulate European culture, yet supposedly, like, they're the ones that, ironically, who get accused of being anti-white, but they want to emulate Europeans culturally, when, like, the conservatives in red state America have this animosity towards anything European. It's kind of like the joke is, like, they didn't like John Kerry because he came across as, like, too French.
Oh, yeah, especially during the whole Freedom Fries debacle.
Yeah.
Well, I think both white liberals and white conservatives like Europe for different reasons. White liberals, especially socialists such as Bernie Sanders, they like Europe on account of its economic justice, on account of its welfare states, whereas many white conservatives, including those on the alt-right, they admire Europe because of the mainstream success of its nationalistic parties such as National Front, UKIP, and others. They sort of pick and choose, if you will.
So, with the election, are you personally leaning more towards Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders?
I mean, right now I'm undecided,
but I'm open. I'm analyzing both of them. I mean, definitely, if it's like Hillary versus Donald Trump, I'll vote for Donald Trump. But if it's Bernie Sanders versus Rubio or Jeb, then I'll vote for Bernie Sanders.
Right, and I know that what I'm about to say may cause me to be vituperated by much of the alt-right, but I support Sanders, and here's my reasoning. Because I think that it's inevitable that a Democrat is going to be elected. Despite the recent popularity of Trump, I don't think he has what it takes to sustain that for the duration of an entire election. And on account of changing demographics, I think that the Republicans have, through their avarice and stupidity, have rendered themselves unelectable on a national level. As California goes, so will go the rest of the nation. So we're going to have a Democrat. But what kind of Democrat are we going to have? Are we going to have another Wall Street-friendly neoliberal such as Hillary Clinton? Or can we at least have someone whose economic policies improve the day-to-day lives of many regular white people, such as Bernie Sanders? I say we go with Sanders.
And Bernie Sanders has some good ideas. I like his ideas. He's talking about taxing Wall Street, taxing speculation, breaking up the big banks.
Right, and speaking of the big banks, one of the reasons we're in this current financial predicament is because Bill Clinton repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial and investment banking. So despite the fact that Clinton gets a lot of undue credit for the economic prosperity of the late 90s, his policies actually planted the seeds of this country's current economic malaise. And the last thing we need is yet another Clinton in office to compound this economic distress.
So the last show I did was with Dota, and we discussed, like, economics, and he has this idea called national capitalism. Would you say you're to the left of Dota economically?
Yes, I would say that I am, because him being an Indian of a trader caste background, he still has a soft spot for some elements of that socially Darwinistic, capitalistic mindset. But at the same time, he's conceded that capitalism, if left to sort of function without regulation or without a sense of nationalism to curtail its excesses, then capitalism can become just as destructive as other systems. And that he recognizes that the problem is that today's elites feel no sense of loyalty towards their populations. They only see labor markets, they only see a labor pool. They don't actually have a sense of stewardship towards their nation, and that's when capitalism sort of is manifested in its most negative forms.
So maybe instead of the alternative right, you'll have to join Robert Lindsay's new movement called the alternative left.
You know, that's funny because Robert Lindsay, despite the fact that he's made many statements to the effect that he doesn't think very highly of the alternative right, it seems that he draws at least some inspiration from the movement. So, the alternative left, I wonder what that would actually look like.
Maybe you could have, like, the radical center, which would take the best from both of them. It's not a bad idea.
Well, yes, I mean, it actually reminds me of what you said during our very first interview, that the ideal is to combine the best ideas of Pat Buchanan with the best ideas of Ralph Nader. And you could say that that's the position I essentially endorse.
As far as areas, would you say, like, the ideal place could combine, like, the best aspects of the Bay Area with, like, the best aspects of middle America?
Yes, in so many words. Sort of the best aspects of the Bay Area, in the sense that you have a vibrant, aesthetically pleasing society, but at the same time you have more sane politics. Maybe the best of Vermont or the best of Iowa. Hard to say, but it's definitely something I've pondered.
I think that is a big flaw with conservatism is they put no value on aesthetics. They're very hostile. Like the kinds of things that do make San Francisco great, they're hostile towards things like historic preservation. They're hostile towards ecological preservation because their view is that those things are barriers to the unfettered free market.
Right, and speaking of the unfettered free market, there's one contradiction that I noticed that exists within the conservative movement, and it's especially pronounced within the alternative right. Because on the one hand, you have these racial nationalists who want to either create or preserve some white ethno-state, and at the same time, there are also many of these libertarian, dog-eat-dog, Ayn Randian-style capitalists. And Andy Nowicki even wrote an article about it called The Patrick Bateman Right, in which he discussed Ayn Randian mindset that pervades much of the alt-right. And here's the problem. You want to create a white ethno-state that is culturally conservative, and yet you support these major capitalists and plutocrats who only care about economic growth and could care less about race, nation, culture, and who have no compunctions about bringing in millions of immigrants just to create their profit margins. So I think that's a major paradox within the alt-right.
Yeah, I think there is a big streak of social Darwinist within the alternative right, especially the manosphere. A lot of the manosphere is definitely driven by social Darwinism.
Oh yeah, but then here's the funny thing: as Nowicki rightly pointed out, if you're going to embrace social Darwinism and espouse socially Darwinistic beliefs, then by what right can you condemn our current elites? Because if social Darwinism is the norm, then we should be worshiping our elites. We should be heaping all kinds of adulation on our elites, because by definition, they're better than us. So it doesn't make a lot of sense at times.
And that kind of mentality, it's one thing to want to better yourself and improve yourself and strive to do great things, but that kind of social Darwinistic mentality, what it really leads to, it leads to people destroying themselves, going into a massive credit card debt so they can buy expensive things to show off. It leads to people committing suicide. I mean, in some extreme cases, it can lead to, like, mass shootings. It does far more destruction than it does to actually encourage people to do great things, I think.
And, more importantly, it sort of precludes any sense of a society, because what's the point of having society if we're all a bunch of atomized individuals striving for more wealth for us, more wealth and more personal enrichment for ourselves. It just creates a greater sense of anomy.
And you wrote this article, The Pitfalls of American Exceptionalism, and
yes.
We've been talking about a lot of these themes. The people who promote American exceptionalism the most, ironically, are like some of the biggest globalists. I remember when Newt Gingrich ran for president in 2012, he made American exceptionalism the cornerstone of his campaign.
Right, and another thing that's ironic is that many of the biggest promoters of American exceptionalism tend to be these SJW types, especially when it comes to the issue of immigration. Because have you heard of Jose Antonio Vargas and his documentary White People?
Oh, the guy from the illegal immigrant from the Philippines, yeah.
Yes. Well, even despite the fact that he's a leftist who criticizes white privilege and he's this big advocate for illegal immigrants, he frequently invokes the language of American exceptionalism and egalitarianism in order to justify his agenda. He's made statements to the effect that, you know, we're a nation of immigrants, and look at Donald Trump, he's calling for Mexicans to be deported, but he ignores his own German immigrant family background. And so the message is basically that, you know, immigration is a fundamental characteristic of the United States.
You know what Bill Maher said the other night? He was saying, like, Donald Trump brought in his immigrant wives, but somewhere a Honduran is in the back of a truck with their stomach pumped with condoms full of cocaine, thinking to themselves, at least I didn't have to come to America by blowing Donald Trump.
And just to make one more point about Trump before we resume our conversation on American exceptionalism, despite the fact that many people on the right are enthusiastic about his anti-immigration statements and think that he's some strong man who will close the border, we need to keep in mind that Donald Trump is ultimately a businessman. And in the past and today, he has and still does employ illegal immigrants. And you really think he's going to completely curtail immigration and risk his business suffering from any kind of... But when all is said and done, and if somehow he's elected president, is he really going to implement border control in earnest, or is he just going to go back to business as usual?
I think you have a point, but the key thing about Donald Trump is that he's pushing the Overton window further out, so he's getting these issues into the debate. So whether Donald Trump is a doesn't really matter as much, whatever you think about him personally, he's pushing these issues out there, and he's forcing the other candidates to talk about it. So I'd say overall, him being in the race is a force for good.
Right, and yes, I promised we would go back to American exceptionalism. Trump frequently makes statements to the effect that we need to make America great again, that we sort of need to restore its values. And you see that the left frequently appropriates this language of American exceptionalism, not just in terms of immigration, but also equality and also the idea that we're a proposition nation and that our founding fathers never intended for the U.S. to be an ethno state or a Christian state. And so about a year ago, I wrote a post called The True Global Minority, where I argued that leftists and liberals in the United States are actually globally deviant. But I've since come to sort of question that logic, because that's not really going to resonate with most Americans, because Americans, in fact, take a lot of pride in the fact that they're globally deviant and that we're mavericks and that we do things differently from Europe.
And you make a lot of points. Americans... What are the traits that are exceptional about Americans? Americans are exceptional when it comes to obesity. Americans have a healthcare system that's utter garbage. Americans take perverse pride in their anti-intellectualism. It's kind of like calling there's this anti-intellectual streak, and you see it a lot on the right, too. Like, if a guy's intellectual, like, oh, he's effeminate, he's a faggot.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, what I was going to say is that I should make it clear that I don't think everything about the United States is bad. What I do think is that the U.S. is a land of extremes. On the one hand, the U.S. has the world's some of the world's most obese people, but the U.S. also wins more Olympic gold medals than any other country. It's anti-intellectual,
actually,
and yet it produces some of the world's most brilliant minds. So it's a the problem that with the U.S., I think, is one of extremes. Just like we don't have a strong middle class anymore, there's no sense of a middle ground when it comes to issues such as obesity, income inequality, or intellectualism.
And Americans, they worship, you make the point, they worship the wealthy elites, and they actually tolerate inequality to a degree that would be unthinkable to any, you say, to the most feet Eurotrash country.
Well, yeah.
And then you say
the
insane amount of hours that Americans put into work would put the most workaholic Japanese to shame.
Indeed, and actually, I decided to recently read Mark Ames' book, Going Postal, myself, and some of the
statistics
he presented were rather harrowing. And he also, what's even more maddening is that he mentions all these regular day-to-day Americans who left these glowing reviews of books written by these sociopathic CEOs such as Chainsaw Al Dunlap or Neutron Jack, and he just pointed out, you know, we're the only idiots in the world that sign up for this miserable
life. Mention the book? Did he mention the book that Donald Trump wrote in the 80s?
Oh, yes. And, you know, there's something perverse about watching a show where he basically humiliates his employees by saying, you're fired. And I'm just thinking, what if Donald Trump is president? Are we going to replicate the whole show, The Apprentice? That's sort of what makes me hesitate and when it comes to supporting him.
Well, he has this whole mentality like everyone is either a winner or a loser.
Well, that's just a more extreme extension of this American bootstrap myth and the whole Protestant work ethic. I don't think it's unique to Donald Trump by any means.
He's just more explicit about it.
Right, for sure.
So what are some of the other points, interesting facts about Mark Ames' Going Postal?
Well, I think what made Mark Ames' Going Postal a fascinating read was that it lays bare the pervasive slave mentality that characterizes today's American society. And he mentioned numerous other historical contexts, such as American slavery or the enslavement of white Europeans by North African slave raiders. And despite the fact that Americans like to think of themselves as these intrepid, independent people who fight back against tyranny and don't want any evil government treading on them, when push comes to shove, they ultimately accept their condition, and they let the elites do as they will. And going back to the effete Euro trash that I mentioned, you know, in Europe, when they try to impose these austerity measures, people are out in the streets, they're fighting with police, they have a three-party system which they can use to vote the current corrupt elites out of power, and yet in the United States, despite the fact that in many ways conditions are far more extreme, people are more docile. So I think it sort of reflects that slave mentality that Ames described.
And with this, we didn't talk about this earlier, with the police state, I mean, people are very complacent. You see rioting among blacks, but among the middle class. Middle class people are terrified of the police. They're terrified of going to prison. And you mentioned that the United States has the largest number of people in prison of every country.
Yes, and that's another great contradiction. The land of the free, but also the prison capital of the world. So, yet again, one of those extremes where there's a lot of unfettered individual freedom, and yet on a collective level, more people are behind bars, there's a rising surveillance state, and there's also, on a day-to-day level, people are more afraid to speak out on account of the proliferation of social media. Dota and I have had many conversations to this effect, and you know, when you're on social media, you basically have to censor yourself because you know that people are watching and you know that prospective employers can, well, they can use your statements against you, so it amounts to censorship.
One thing I did notice about San Francisco that's interesting is that I noticed a much lower police presence than in Southern California. If you go to even the richest areas of L.A., I mean, you see cops everywhere. The police in Southern California are much more militarized. Did you notice that difference as well?
Yes, and there's actually there's a historical reason for this. I've been starting to read the book Fast Food Nation, and the author describes how during the World War II era, the federal government pumped in $20 billion into L.A., alone in its surrounding areas, and you had all kinds of bases and ports and other forms of military infrastructure being developed there. And even after the war, defense spending accounted for at least a third of the jobs in that region. And in fact, if you look at the movie Falling Down, have you ever seen that?
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Well, the protagonist of the film, Defense, he was a former defense contractor, and one of the reasons why he fell down was because in the aftermath of the Cold War, he had lost his defense job. So you can kind of see how that region greatly benefited from the American military. So it's not surprising that it's one of the more militarized regions, whether it's in terms of actual military itself or its high police presence.
What were your observations of the police when you were in Orange County?
Well, I did notice that they often did not have anything good to do. I recall one incident where there was one car that had crashed, and I saw about seven cop cars descend in the area.
So that would be less common in the Bay Area.
Right. Well, because Orange County doesn't really need much of a police presence, because aside from Santa Ana, it's more wealthy, more white and Asian, and so there's a little less friction there than in other parts of the state.
With the whole issue of mass incarceration, I know a lot of people on the right, including the alternative right, they have this mentality that most people who end up in prison are criminals who deserve it. Or they defend it, or their attitude is that most of them are black, so they deserve to be in prison. Like, it's not just the mainstream right. I think I hear this in the alternative right as well. But
right.
Just think about the numbers. I mean, we have more people in prison than China, which has four times as many people as us. I mean, it's insane.
And also, I'm glad you mentioned blacks, because a lot of people, when pointing to the U.S.'s abnormally high incarceration rate, they often claim that it's just a matter of blacks being racially discriminated against and disproportionately put behind bars. But there's more to it than that, because plenty of other countries have racial minorities, and plenty of them face even worse problems in this regard than blacks. For example, I heard in France that North Africans account for grossly disproportionate percentage of prisoners there, and yet France's overall incarceration rate is still much lower than the United States. So I think a lot of it just has to do with draconian sentencing laws and the fact that the U.S. has this sort of law and order, tough on crime ethos.
So before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics, about the San Francisco Bay Area or about the topic of American exceptionalism?
Well, I think there's just one more thing we have to add about American exceptionalism, because despite the fact that the alt-right is rightly sort of nonplussed by some of the more bizarre manifestations of American liberalism, especially when situated in a global context. I think in order to make greater inroads with regular people, we have to sort of speak to them in terms that they understand. So we sort of have to find a way to use American exceptionalism in our favor when it comes to advancing our arguments. Now, how that is done, well, I guess that will have to be the subject of a future post.
I think a good, I want to maybe in the future, like, expand more on the topic of like, whether there can be a sort of radical center, as I mentioned, like, combining, like, the best of Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader.
Yes. That would definitely be a topic worth exploring.
Because, to be honest, I think anything that's right-wing is really it's a dead end.
Well, at least the right-wing as it exists in its current American form. But I think the American right, speaking of a global context, could learn a lot from its counterparts around the world about how to successfully make inroads in politics and not just be relegated to the fringe.
Some neoconservative writer was trying to say that Donald Trump is more like a European populist, like Marine Le Pen, than a real red-blooded American conservative. Which, if that's true, that would be a great thing. Who knows?
Yeah, well, we'll see how much of a populist Trump remains if and when he ever obtains any position of power.
But he does have all the right enemies. I mean, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Sheldon Adelson, Rupert Murdoch, all those scumbags hate him. So he must be doing something right.
Yes, something right. But just because scumbags hate you does not make you a virtuous person.
That's true. But since when did he claim to be has he ever claimed to be a virtuous person?
Well, I don't think he has, but a lot of people are deifying him, so you must somehow convey that impression.
Barry Geifer, Bernie Sanders. That's how I'll put it.
All right, I'll brace myself for the inevitable vitriol.
Put up like an official endorsement banner on Occident Invicta. Bernie Sanders 2016.
Well, I'd have to clear that with Dota first. I don't think he'd approve too much, but maybe I could persuade him.
So, Barry Guy, it's been a great show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.